Welcome everyone to the Third Opinion Uncensored. This is a podcast exploring public health, media, science, health and well-being and censorship in these times of COVID, post-COVID, retro-COVID, meta-COVID. We will look beyond the media headlines to create a space for critical thinking, intelligent debate and the freedom to dialogue. This week we'll be interviewing, here in the studio with us, Kimberly McConchie, a nurse and obstetric sonographer who was deregistered during that wonderful COVID crazy restriction time and, surprisingly to many, is still locked out of her chosen profession due to the experimental COVID injection mandates, which continue for some reason. Is that right? You were given the choice in October 2020 to either toe the line or leave your work as a senior IVF sonographer and educator. And she chose to resign. Although banned from her profession for over 30 years, she spoke out about her concerns publicly very early on and supported a multitude of other Australian healthcare workers who held a similar view. More than 3 years on and still believing in the innate goodness of humans, we can see you out there, guys. Kimberly is keen to initiate open conversation about the trauma we've all experienced, the injustices still at hand, and how we can all move on from the absurd new post-COVID world we find ourselves in. So today we hope that we can focus on the much-needed next step of how can we forgive and move towards solutions after the mental health crisis that we've all gone through, knowing that healing comes from forgiveness and being able to embrace where we are. Welcome to the show.
Wow, that's quite an introduction. Thanks, Eva. And it's quite an honour, actually, to be on the show. I've been listening to some of your podcasts and it's been so exciting to actually hear some very special people, Ian Brighthope, Gianthi, Dr. DeMello. There's just so many amazing people you've had on the show. So credit to you.
We've been very lucky, and particularly Jair, to have the wisdom to not censor media. Thank goodness.
Thanks for having me.
We're still waiting for the first letter to arrive. Okay.
You're the Lone Ranger.
Let's start off with a very simple question, and anyone's welcome to ask. Why did you decide to refuse the injection when all your colleagues went ahead with it, I assume, given the sort of work you were doing?
It just didn't seem necessary. The risk benefit ratio just wasn't there. It was an experimental injection. I don't believe it's a vaccine, but that's debatable. Mm-hmm. So for the recovery rate for most of us, we knew that the elderly population, there were certain demographics that were more at risk, but most of us weren't. So the thought of taking an experimental injection just for the sake of keeping my job, there was something inherently morally wrong about it from the start. And I think that's what got my back up from the start.
And I assume that you were also aware that there were some early treatment options, because it's not like it was the jab or nothing. There was another option that we weren't being told about as well. So maybe talk a little bit about that, because did that influence your opinion about whether to take it or not?
It did. It did, although I didn't believe having a pretty robust immune system, I really needed those. So, yes, am I allowed to say those naughty words, ivermectin?
Yes, after the 2 years when they were needed, they're now legal to prescribe again.
Yeah. So I worked in the field of fertility for a long time, and a lot of our patients were on hydroxychloroquine, not so much ivermectin unless they had scabies.
Why were they on hydroxychloroquine?
Just they may have had immune disorders that required them being on it. Mm-hmm. The dose that they were on was quite small, though. It was only about 200 milligrams a day. Mm-hmm. So when those studies were put out on hydroxychloroquine initially, I think they were backed by Fauci. I'm not entirely sure. But they were using loading doses of over 2 grams a day, like in a 24-hour period.
Yes. That study, yes. Yeah. That was they were being overdosed.
Yes. So we knew the cardiac complications that were coming were set up. Mm-hmm. So there were talking about censorship, there were things like that that were concerning. I'm not too sure of the time frame with that, but there were things like that I was worried about.
So you were looking at the details, and you're coming at it as a nurse who's looking at data. So you're not just trusting mainstream media. What happens with people that don't understand? Because a lot of us who went in and did the research, and we're both, you know, health professionals, ex-health professionals, so we're coming in looking at data and interested in that, and that's where the skepticism first arose. What would happen to people that didn't understand that? Like, how would you explain it to, say, your patients who would come in? Your thoughts about it?
I think this is what got me in trouble, Eva, from the start, is I did explain it to my patients. I wasn't prepared to toe the line. So in my consults with patients, I would close the door and say, we've known each other, some of them for 10 years, 2 years.
So they've been on IVF for 10 years?
Some of them have been on IVF for a long time.
Wow.
And I would say to them, I've known you for a long time. Let's just stop, pause, take a big step back. We have no longitudinal safety data on these things. Some of these health precautions, the way we're managing this, just they're against everything that we've been taught. So I would say to the patient, let's just take a pause, step back, let's just watch for a little while and get some safety data before you launch into this. And unfortunately, that was against what a lot of people were hearing, and some of my patients fed that back to management, and I ended up in quite deep water.
So here you are having to deal with the ethics as a health professional, where you know they haven't done the research at all. They hadn't done any research with pregnant women and how much it was affecting fertility. So you're very concerned. And what are you meant to do from an ethical perspective? Do no harm. What are you meant
to
do?
That is the first rule in medicine. First, do no harm.
So that was your best way of doing no harm, was informing them, informed consent, which, again, was something that was meant to have been done.
Yeah, you kind of wonder how do no harm fits into an experimental medication.
Well, the other thing you have to remember with a lot of patients or people that aren't like us that have got some sort of health background is when you step into that hospital or clinic, it's very overwhelming. And it's very easy to hand over full care. I have infertility. It's now your infertility. You manage it for me. And some of them are immensely trusting because they don't have the confidence to, and sometimes they're time poor, that I want to take the time to research it for themselves.
And it takes a lot of time. And I think that for people like you, hundreds, thousands of hours of research later.
And I'm going.
did you make a mistake, do you think? Or were you? Has time proven? Like, is there any data to prove that not taking it would have been a better fertility outcome than taking it?
In my eyes, in my humble nursing, obstetric, gynae, no. I'm convinced it probably isn't the best thing, but then that's my choice.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, and there's research there to support that?
Yes. Well, if you look at the Pfizer studies, I mean, TGA apparently took the glossy brochure and didn't look at the raw data, but there weren't many rats that were pregnant that did very well.
Well, I think we have a problem here in Australia because, I think we assumed at the beginning that Australia would look at the data themselves and make a decision based on our own assessment, but it turns out that that's not how it really works around here.
Can I just jump in for a second?
Yeah.
In the first 5 minutes we've been talking, we've gone through the process of what actually happened here because you've got this new situation, an experiment is done, and it comes out with information that is a setup, right? It's set up to fail.
What do you mean?
Well, we were talking about the hydroxychloroquine before,
right?
Where they were giving huge doses. To see if
A setup. Yeah, that was actually a setup.
So here we have an example of research data being set up to give the answer that would suit the narrative. You then have that passed on to all the well-meaning doctors who for decades have trusted these government initiatives, and they've gone with this information to their patients with such zeal that anyone who questions it is considered to be a witch and burned at the stake.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, Michael, because initially when I was working for one of Melbourne's top IVF companies, and I had worked there for many, many years, for decades, normally when there's a new paradigm in thinking, what happens is there's like a team meeting where every department gets together with the senior representatives from the departments, and you have a round table discussion. So everyone's on the same page. You have consistency in protocol. Everyone speaks the same language to patients. So when this first happened, that was my first tact. I approached the state manager and said, look, this is normally what we do. Let's get everyone together, the doctors, the embryologists, the scientists, everyone. Let's have a chat and we'll sort this out because we've got some great brains here.
As you would.
Nope, we're not doing that. And I said, what do you mean we're not doing that? That's what grown-ups do. Nope, not interested. The doctors aren't interested. They're all going down the path of the narrative. That's it, end of story. So that was a really big flag to me at that time.
That happened whilst you were at work. Mm. You tried to do that and you saw something different happening. The reaction was different to normal. Mm. And I guess that...
And that was one prime example of the censorship. It started really early on.
Mm. Yeah. I'm looking at that article you're talking about, hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine with or without macrolide for treatment of COVID-19, and I'm trying to find the dosage because they didn't include it in there. And that was the problem, that the doctors that refer to these studies have no idea about the background story. They don't know the background stories. And I had a conversation yesterday on Twitter Spaces, and, you know, it was just really interesting. I heard a couple doctors speak, and they just point after point, which was completely wrong. And it was great to be able to get on and then, you know, refute things, because that's what happens, is that you know that the data being shared is missing out the most important parts. And the thing that a lot of Australians don't know is that the TGA, our Therapeutic Goods Administration in Australia, they are
97% funded. By pharma.
Let's argue over this, because I thought it was 96.
Okay. I'm an optimist. You can take that either way.
And if you want the data on that, it's in the British Medical Journal 2022, from FDA to MHRA, are drug regulators for hire. Marianne DeMussy, who used to do that wonderful show called Catalyst until she was very naughty and she spoke out against statins, and she came up with the conclusion that statins were actually not necessarily good for your health. And she lost the show. She's a fantastic journalist and science researcher. But it says here that we of all countries in the world, we are very special because we have the highest proportion of budget from industry fees.
Yep.
And that in 2020 to 2021, they approved more than 9 out of 10 every drugs that were applied for to the TGA. And that when it came to the COVID injections, that we relied on the data that was coming from, guess who? The drug companies. Yes, the vaccine sponsor. And they said that, so they tried to defend it, but the information provided by the vaccine sponsor, which we now know there are thousands and thousands of pages of data that was hidden and only was released
last
year because of some lovely judge in the USA.
And just another word of doom and gloom. The big pharma's basically funding the institutions that are teaching our next generation of doctors
We've heard of the Flexner Report that was written in the early 1900s.
What's that?
So the Flexner Report was a report that was commissioned, I believe, by the Rockefellers. And it was a report. They worked out that in order to get a new league of medications into the market, petroleum-based medications,
of course,
they had a fierce competitor in the natural medicine sector. So they had to somehow discredit natural medicine to be able to flood their products on the market. So they commissioned Flexner, a reporter, to write this report that I guess discredited natural medicine. And it was very powerful.
And that's just about to happen again over in Canada, where natural therapies are being cut out of the National Health Service. You know,
You can't get naturopathy anymore, even under our private health insurance anymore. That's been pushed out. And the Flexner Report, homeopathy, traditional osteopathy, eclectic medicine and physiomedicalism, botanical therapies, were derided in that report. And I guess we hear a lot about now, on a different level, that the introduction of mRNA technology was part of what COVID did, so that mRNA became a household word, and now we've got couple factories popping up around.
Oh, one in
Grand Melbourne.
Yeah,
Monash University.
Monash University is making one. Yeah.
So that was a important part of the.
But actually, Eva, look at the interview that you did with it wasn't Ian Brighthope, with DeMello, Dr. DeMello.
Yeah.
He mentioned vitamin D in that too.
Yeah.
Natural medicine. Yeah. It was totally suppressed. No one said anything at the start of COVID about the crucial part of vitamin D in fighting off COVID. One of the easiest and the most natural things we could
and
have
done.
And
the most effective.
Yeah.
Well, us locked up people need a class action for missing out on the sunshine.
Lock them up. Don't let them get the sun. Oh, no.
And if you're interested. Incredulous. If you're, in Israel they did some really big studies with vitamin D. And here on, if you go to C19early.org, you can look at all the vitamin D studies done for COVID. There were 112 treatment studies. With 183,000 patients in 32 countries. And overall, every single study showed it to be from effective to extremely effective in terms of reducing severity of disease and death.
See, I think our health system's now based around getting the patient in, getting them out as quickly as possible, and the quickest way to do that is to give them a prescription for a tablet that's available at the chemist that will relieve some of their symptoms.
Versus
treating cause.
It's not a health system.
Treating and even more important system. Than cause is treating is prevention, is it advising is. On prevention. Mm.
That takes a lot of time, Michael.
Yeah, well.
And people don't follow through. I mean, why would you bother telling someone to reduce weight?
Because that's your job. And, you know, just about every. I don't know what word you're allowed to use for larger person, goes into their doctor to consult about their weight situation. They'll often be told to do some exercise, eat better, and possibly take a medication.
Are you talking about taking responsibility for their own health?
And here we go.
How dare... Oh, sorry.
Here we go.
There are things, and unfortunately not enough doctors maybe know about it or do it, and they can refer to... I used to work with Diabetes Victoria as a health coach on their Life program, and it's free. Like, you've got free telephone coaching to help you lose weight and to exercise more and to do all those things. There actually are systems in place, but... A fraction of people, there are many things, but it's not the way. And even you just see, you know, someone comes in with depression. I spoke yesterday with a friend who's started the day before on an antidepressant, and I looked at her. I said, "How about A, B, C, D, E, F?" And she goes, "Have you done those?" And she goes, "No." I said, "How about trying that just for 1 month and see how you feel?" And she agreed to do that.
Wow,
and,
that's great.
And, you know, we're trying to put together peer-to-peer support networks of that, because it does take peer support to make behaviour change. We tend to do the things, as we saw during COVID, we tend to do what the people around us are doing. And, you know, that's why the media campaigns were so successful, because that just became the way everyone was agreeing. And, yes, and how, and you know, as you know, if you just took a step outside of that circle, there was a response. There was a social response. And if you did it on Facebook, oh, my goodness, that was exciting. But
so how do we turn that social response around in order that Kim gets apology and offer of reinstatement from her former institution?
I think I'm not waiting for that anymore, Michael.
All right. Well, let's take your individual – well, no, let's talk about your individual situation a bit more. But generally, there are a lot of people in that situation. I mean, I know I was applying for jobs with the Department of Health, and all of them at the bottom said, you must be vaccinated even just to apply for a job.
Mm.
Right? And that's still going on now.
It is.
We're talking about a jab that nobody wants to take anymore anyway. And it's for a strain that was around a while ago, and it's just
years ago.
It's ridiculous.
The most ridiculous thing is that the government has now instructed employers to destroy records because this is a breach of privacy.
Yeah.
Yet people are still asking for a COVID vaccine as part of the. If you have a look on Seek, you can see some
Seek?
Job mm-hmm. yeah, advertisers will actually put what is your COVID-19 vaccination status. Mm. So it's just...
And that's not legal anymore, is it? They're not really allowed ask for that.
They can ask for it and you give them the piece of paper and they have to destroy it. Mm.
But there is, and Eva, cut me off if I'm jumping ahead, there is a silver lining in all of this because...
Please tell us.
Without
this,
we wouldn't have stopped, sat back on our nellies and looked at the big picture and realised exactly what was going on. I mean, the trust in medicine now... and I work in medicine and health, has just plummeted for very good reason because, as Michael said before, unfortunately a lot of doctors have become pharma pimps and so have nurses because that's what we've been conditioned to do. So we've got this great...
Do you think they're aware of that?
Do you think they think they're doing the right thing?
There are some that naively do. There are, look...
Many naively do.
Most of our healthcare workers in the hospital still are really at heart good people. They're in a bad system. A really bad system.
And it just shows how the systems around us are so important in terms of ethics. It's like kids in the school. You see, if you go into a school where there's a culture of support and cooperation and collaboration, it affects how everybody gets on. It affects their mental health. And if you go into a school where there's bullying and there's power from above and there's not that, it changes people. And I think that we're in a very stressful situation. I think for people working in the system, who has the time to do what you and I might have done, which is spend literally thousands of hours to work it out? You know, you have to have knowledge, you have to have the time, you have to have the motivation. And if you're going to be, you know, looking into something which you know that you can't actually adhere to, why would you even do it? If you know that you can't afford to leave your job because of whatever reason, that you're the main breadwinner, why would you even do it?
And this is the thing that I find the most curious about our situations is what is it in people like you and I that made our being, every part of us, just stand up and say, no, this is wrong. My life is worth, or my health is worth me saying no, I just can't.
Well, I think that I'm someone who tends to investigate every aspect of health. Mm. I have a blood disorder, so I already was curious.
And that, for a lot of people, is the trigger. They had some sort of experience.
Yeah, I'd had some experiences that were, and I'd always found that through doing the research and looking at the whole picture. In fact, you know, that's what I do now in my work. I teach people this approach. Mm. And that you find through that, and never to just trust one person, always multiple opinions and making sure that it wasn't coming from vested interests. And I guess what was so upsetting was that you realised that the further you dug, the more there was. And it wasn't from random, you know, conspiracy theorists. It was from professors and scientists and doctors and people that had zero vested interest in saying, you know, speaking out, because they would lose their profession, they would lose, like you, their job. Mm. It was from people who were coming from a very authentic voice. And I guess what we have to look at now is how do we let people come back together and the authentic voices to be heard at
some of our best voices at the time, I remember, were very experienced doctors who had recently retired. So they had nothing to lose.
Yeah.
And they were just doing it out of the goodness of their heart.
We had Professor Clancy on the show, you know, a month ago or so. And, you know, Professor Clancy, so well respected, is now seen as a outsider. You know, it's people that are super bright, you know, super insightful, who he's an immunologist. Like he, you know, just shocked.
There are so many in Melbourne. Yeah. Mark Hobart, Dr. Mark Hobart, mm-hmm. Dr. Catherine Fiennes. Duncan Sines. We have some incredible minds here.
And many, many, many doctors. I found it interesting. I'd walk into a clinic and I would have a conversation with, you know, I take my mother to a lot of different doctors. And the majority now are definitely no, but they wouldn't say it out loud. That's all. They'll say it privately, but they won't say it out loud. And, you know, that's understandable.
And would they still jab a patient tomorrow?
They weren't jabbers, so that wasn't their job, you know. Like, that's just
different doctors.
Let's go back to Sean. Should we get back on track? Tell us about what you did. So you were isolated, and you formed a group.
So when I first left work, and it was my choice to leave.
Yeah,
and I just managed to meet this incredible dynamo of a woman, and I'm sure she won't mind me saying her name, Elma Bessenden, her name is. And she's been a company CEO. She's a an absolute powerhouse of strength. So the two of us got together, and largely it was her impetus. We managed to be connected with a small group of doctors initially, nationally from around Australia. We were meeting up on Zoom because you weren't, of course, at that point allowed to meet up face-to-face. So week by week, we had a Zoom every Monday night that Alma and I would host. And over time, we collected hundreds of people from around Australia, other healthcare workers, paramedics, and then beyond, where it was like a safe place, a refuge for people to gain validity again, I suppose. So that group turned into an action group where we were distributing letters to help people stand up against coercive work.
So you were giving them a process that they could use and language they could use and letters they could share with their employer?
Yep. We were running education sessions and had some brilliant speakers from around Australia come on talking about alternative medicines, about human relations, having those difficult discussions with the employers. Mm-hmm. So it became a group to try and help other professionals.
Mm-hmm. And that was very important because in the same way that the social group that said we're going to comply, the group had to come together who said we're going to stand up. They needed to have support, a community that actually validated. Because the isolation for many people was really overwhelming and caused a lot of mental health issues on both sides.
Mm. And as soon as
how did you go when the people took your advice and letters and went to their employer and got nowhere?
I don't believe there were many cases at all that did very well because Australians just submitted. There wasn't a lot of pushback at all. And I think for a while it was quite obvious that a lot of the healthcare workers that we were meeting were in shock. And, you know, we've had such a great run in Australia. We've not had a civil war. We've not had any reason to distrust our government. And I think a lot of us were really good people and just thought they'll get it. You know, they'll get it. Yeah. It'll turn around.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's still a lot of people even now, I think, that they believe that the government will help them.
What do you mean?
I think that, you know, things will turn around. That, you know, they'll admit they've made a mistake and everything will be fixed. And
doesn't sound like a politician. Mate, wouldn't
you're asking a very big one here. I haven't trusted politicians since Gough Whitlam.
You're not living in Victoria, are you?
But this is the thinking. This is the mentality that a lot of our healthcare, they were good people and they really believed that they hadn't done anything wrong, which they hadn't. And I think for a lot of them, it was a really big slap with a wet fish, a wake-up call. That know that, you know, the workplaces and what was going on wasn't right and it wasn't okay. Yeah. So, no, we didn't get much positive response from those letters.
Yeah, and it just shows, doesn't it, that you can be in a system where things are so wrong and people end up going along bit by bit. It's just the, you know, the frog in the water.
The boiling frog, absolutely.
And it just, the temperature keeps on turning up and up and you don't notice what's happening because it's just you can't pick up the...
In your situation, A, you were coerced. First, you weren't given informed consent. Then you were coerced. Then you lost your job. And now you're being punished for not having taken it when there was some possibility that it may have been useful.
But you know the crazy thing, though? Even now, if they said, all's forgiven, we want you back, it's been such a great wake-up call and a chance to sit back and reevaluate the whole system for me. I wouldn't want to go back and work there the way it is at the moment. There would have to be some radical... You know, there's the best way I can think about explaining it, and it's a little bit gross, but we are kind of all hell people, but it's like this great big boil that's happening at the moment, and there's all this horrible pus and stuff... festering underneath it, all this
we
stuff.
We definitely need that pot of boiling water, don't we?
We do. Yeah. And we're like, it's almost like we're waiting for this pustule to pop and all the rubbish and everything to come out in the open so everyone can see exactly what's happening.
You're
so
an unrealistic optimist, aren't you?
Oh, God, you've picked it, haven't you? And I have been waiting, I think, for that to happen. And it's taken a long time to realise that some people are... Can you imagine, Eva, if you were a parent who... was misled and, you know, really strongly went out and thought, I'm getting my kids injected because I think it's the right thing to do. If those kids turn around and have a vax injury or they're infertile, you have to live with yourself for the rest of your life. So there's some people that just will I don't think they'll ever pull their heads out of the sand because that's a really harsh...
I think it's hard for people to imagine it, and because people are so caught up in their own little world, and if the people around them are all thinking the same, if they all have the same think, they don't see it. And what we've seen, I guess, is it just takes one person who's been injured, then suddenly the people around them have a different opinion. And a lot of the people who are also on side early, and I know that you've also had issues, you had a son that was unwell.
Mm-hmm.
So that changes how you think about things because you've had to go through that process of consideration of, am I being given the right solution? So there's sort of a few different groups. There's people that are maybe very, you know, over critical thinkers or over researchers. There are people who have already had harm in the past. There were people that had harm from the whole process, just through the coercion. And I think there's just these different groups. And there are people that come from countries where they've seen where the government suddenly changes and things go from being optional to being mandatory. So you've got...
A lot of Eastern European... People have come from Eastern European backgrounds. They know how a government...
And South American. So you would see that there seems to be a bit of a pattern to the people that were sceptical and also a pattern to the people that weren't.
Mm.
You know, I don't think it's rocket science, but you just see that unless, and that's why, you know, this radio that's why this radio show is important, because people don't hear it because it's censored. Because of the Trusted News Initiative censorship of our media,
that
people don't hear the voices.
That was only 2019. Did you realize? I thought it was much earlier than that, but it was only 2019.
Yeah, it was plugged in as under the guise of, you know, catching terrorists.
Yes.
For the election, the American elections.
And the Telecommunications Act in 1996, that changed things too.
And we've got a bill coming up in our own parliament soon, by 20th of August. Get your submission in and tell them to just go away and leave us alone.
So let's just explain that, because I think it's really important to talk about this misinformation bill.
But before you do that, Eva,
one
little take a breath. Take a deep breath. What station are we on?
It's J.
You're listening to JAir88 FM, Australia's only Jewish community radio station, and on the web, j-air.com.au. JAir needs your membership. Keeps us on the air for only $54 a year. Your membership enables us to pay our bills.
Only $54 a year?
It's cheap. Australian
We're
bucks.
Cheap.
That's only a couple of
quality
coffees
Quality radio.
Yeah, where else would you hear such radio?
Quality, that's what you need. Like the show you're currently listening to, join up via our website, j-air.com.au.
We may not be here much longer.
This is the third opinion.
Did you do car sale? Oh, sorry.
There's a layer above all the healthcare workers and the institutions they work for, and that's the people who are funding them, which is basically the government. And if...
Who's funding the government?
We do. Thank you. We do. And we just listen to the stuff that comes from the media under government narrative direction. And it's all clear in 2019, Trusted News Initiative. We're all going to say tells us. Trusted News Initiative, where all the major news networks in the world agree that they're going to follow the same story so that they can support the right thing to do.
They were doing anything to avoid vaccine hesitancy was the main criteria of why early treatment information and vaccine injury information was suppressed in the media. So that's why we go out of our way to talk about these things, because free speech is very important. We are post-Holocaust Jews ourselves.
Yep.
And we saw what happens when you bring censorship into media.
And I think from now on, conspiracy theorist term should be banned. And whenever you feel like using it, you now call yourself a realist theorist.
Well, don't they
because
say
that's what
they're
happened.
They're no longer theories when they become true. So
yes,
yeah.
So the difference just between the two is about six months. Probably only 3 months now.
It's such a fun rhyme. I like it.
Although, thankfully now, and I don't know why it's starting to happen now, but we are seeing some headlines in our mainstream media about
in the Australian
exactly what's going on
and in Parliament,
Herald Sun.
A lot of Senate.
Harold
Sun had one about...
That was an interesting one, given what we're talking about, Eva. It was actually the 125 Victorian healthcare workers that are off on disability payments.
Only 125.
That's got to be. I mean, if you look at the VAERS data, you know that only 1% or so of injuries, of vaccine injuries, are reported. So if we translate it somewhere over here, it's got to be way more than that.
I think I saw some data today saying 2% are reported. Anyway, that was a new data that just came up. Was it two?
Yeah, it was low. Yes, 2% was.
But we are seeing in the media, so just even with regards to this misinformation bill, and this is what has been written in The Australian, some of the headlines are...
The Ministry of Truth will decide what social media...
That's a little bit Harry Potter,
is allowed.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
Lawyer Justin Quill wrote in The Australian, misinformation bill will only feed conspiracy. Even in the very best drafting cannot fix a bad idea. And the misinformation and disinformation bill is as bad a legislative idea or concept as I've seen. And there are people speaking out in the papers, and there is an opportunity to respond by the 20th of August, which is only days, actually.
Did you hear Albo was on the radio and somebody asked him a question, what would you do if you were a dictator? And I thought, what do you mean, if? But his answer was, he'd ban all social media.
I did say that, actually.
I'm thinking, you don't want the people talking to each other and spreading ideas.
So there's a group called AMPS. Are you part of AMPS?
I have been involved with AMPS, yes.
Yep. Sorry. And they say the proposed powers would. Can you just...
Which one am I reading? Enable the ACMA, to gather information from digital platform providers or require them to keep certain records about matters regarding misinformation and disinformation. So far, it sounds like a really good idea. Keep us all well educated. Enable the ACMA to request industry develop a code of practice covering measures to combat misinformation and disinformation on digital platforms, which the ACMA could register and enforce. Right, so there's going to be penalties for the platforms not doing what they're told. Allow the ACMA to create and enforce an industry standard. This is scary. A stronger form of regulation. Should a code of practice be deemed ineffective in combating misinformation and disinformation on digital platforms? So the way I read that is that the government Ministry of Truth will decide what is misinformation or disinformation. There is no argument allowed. And there are penalties for doing the wrong thing.
I actually think I saw today on one of the social media channels that Albo wants to get rid of, I actually saw an excerpt from a paper from the Second World War, and it was basically something coming out of Nazi Germany of that effect, that you will not discuss any other form of... So how's it any different?
Don't know. The proposed bill could inadvertently hinder practitioners' ability to provide unbiased and evidence-based guidance. It could undermine the trust between medical professionals and patients, compromising the integrity of healthcare systems. I mean, that's just bang, bang, bang. You can't go anywhere with that. So doctors not allowed to give a clinical decision due to an administrative decision.
APRA already started it. Did you see the statement that APRA put out in March of 2021? Gagging all of us?
Yep.
Yeah.
I've got a copy.
You know how many doctors I've asked about, did you receive that letter, and they've denied it?
They've denied it?
Yeah, never got the letter. It's in the post.
I've written so many letters, love letters to APRA, to Scott Morrison, to all our...
Yeah.
I'm on the Christmas card list this year.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's interesting when you look at what gives APRA authority to do what they do. And it's just sort of higgledy-piggledy all around the country, different here and there.
Yeah, it is, and I think they're running scared because they've actually just emailed a lot of us who've deregistered and said, we're very curious to know, why have you deregistered? So I thought, I'll help them out. So I've printed off every letter, every bit of communication I've had with them and Scott Morrison and all the other MPs and ATAGI and APRA and TGA. Packed it into a little envelope and I've posted it off to them last week.
In the post?
I did.
Yeah, I reckon it'll get lost in the post.
Registered mail.
Oh, good.
Yep. Good on you.
Good, keep the number.
So I think they know.
Okay. So we know that something's rotten.
In Denmark.
What what can we do moving forward? What do you see as the positive steps? And for anyone listening out there, it can be a bit overwhelming, but, you know, we're dealing with a new landscape and it's important that people know that and know how to respond to that, because ultimately healthcare is about healthcare, not illness care or illness. What's the terminology you use?
Well-being, promotion of well-being.
And there are many ways to do that outside of the medical system. What do you think will emerge from this?
So already in Australia, there's some really good stuff is happening. There's a group called the PHA.
So what's the website? Is there a website for that?
They do tend to communicate more through Telegram.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Public Health Alliance. It's a UK-based initiative set up by a woman by the name of Catherine McBean, I think her name was. So it's come out from the UK.
What does PHA stand for?
Public Health Alliance.
Public Health Alliance.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so it's a group of predominantly health professionals, but others as well.
Or is it People's Health Alliance?
Oh, actually, yeah, People's Health Alliance.
Okay,
sorry,
so I'm just going to share the website just so people can have a look at this. This looks like it. The dash.
Yep.
Everyone likes a dash. All the cool places have got dashes. The dash PHA.org. And for the people, by the people, an organic, people-led, integrated health initiative that aims to educate, support and empower people to take responsibility for their own health, which certainly was a huge asset during COVID if you knew what you could do to protect yourself. And most importantly, actually now, is to prevent long COVID by having early treatment. That was very interesting. Dr. DeMello's shared that.
Yeah.
26,000 patients and long COVID's not
been
an issue.
There's some great resources now for people who feel like they're experiencing COVID injection side effects or long COVID, if you like. The World Council for Health, WCH, have a fabulous spike protein detox guide that people can access really readily. The FLCCC, which is an American frontline group of ICU specialists, have got a couple of protocols that you can look at as well.
FLCCC.net is the link for that, and World Council for Health is another one. WorldCouncilForHealth.org.
Yep. There are some other fantastic initiatives that have come out of this. I'm not sure if you heard of the My Place set up around Victoria. So My Place is a fabulous community-based incentive that's popping up. Frankston, Doncaster.
Yeah, there's a Bayside, there's a St Kilda.
Yeah, a lot of them. So these are people getting together, they're sharing resources, bartering, swapping, having markets, helping with emotional or physical support. So people are banding together.
And as a health professional, what do you see as what can people like you do if you can't work in your chosen profession? What's your options? Are there ways that your experience and your knowledge around infertility, can that be used in other ways?
It's been a great time, Eva. I've been driving trucks. I've been packing chocolates. I've been working in cafes, doing a lot of things I would never have had the courage to do. I think ultimately I have to head back to health, but my new paradigm of health, like a lot of people in Australia, has changed. What I was once confident in and believed in is now no longer. I think there's a real head back towards natural medicine. So those people who might have been a little bit quirky and on the outside doing natural medicine or intravenous nutraceuticals, naturopathy, homeopathy, that's starting to reemerge as people are looking more for alternatives to medicine. They don't want to pop a pill anymore. They actually want to take initiative. And this is the great thing about what's happening. People who have been doing the research and are starting to wake up are now wanting to take responsibility for their own health. And it's great.
And it looks like there's more and more frameworks for that to happen. And the more they try to suppress it, I guess the more important it is that people know where to go to get the whole range of information, more balanced information, as opposed to the censorship approach, which just doesn't work in a democracy, if that's what you like to live in.
So a lot of healthcare professionals like myself are now looking at other areas to retrain in, so functional medicine. Intravenous nutraceuticals.
Come work in my cannabis dispensary.
Okay. Oh, CBD oil, yeah, fantastic.
Isn't that crazy?
Really good for long COVID.
Doing some research on things that CBD can be used for.
So many things.
And inflammation in so many ways.
And as far as any mental health issues.
Yep. And it's a homeostatic effect. Yep. I don't know if you've done any sort of reading about endocannabinoid system.
Obviously not enough, but
it affects so many other of the systems that we are more familiar with, and it's just been ignored ever since it was made illegal.
Yep.
And it's incredible.
And what's so wrong, though?
Don't let the effect of stigma against THC effect in the plant enter into this conversation of the effectiveness of CBDs.
Separate to CBD.
Because that's really important. A lot of people think, you know, you're going to get stoned. You don't. And it has some amazing effects. Talk to your doctor. Like, otherwise, talk to me.
Well, just even with sleep, so that instead of taking drugs that have been shown to have terrible long-term side effects in terms of even longevity, for example.
Well, if you're talking sleep, anxiety and pain, that's a lot of people.
Yeah. But the problem is, like my mother is on CBD oil. Sorry, Mum, it's okay to tell people. for pain.
Your mum's a stoner.
$190 for a little bottle of oil, which is safe, versus, you know, paying, what, $12
natural?
For something which is potentially harmful.
Yeah.
That's what's so distressing about the current system. And I get that in itself, like just looking at that and how hard it was for her to get that, because we were trying for years. And she was scared of it because she had to read and sign special things, whereas she'd go to the, you know, she'd get opioids over the counter, you know, with no warning that she could read because it was too small.
They should make a regulation that all the side effects have to be written in the same size font. Yeah. As the supposed positive.
Oh,
event.
Did you see the the leaflets that came with the COVID special medicine? Nothing on them. Nothing. Blank. Printed blank.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So this is one of the beautiful things that's come out of it. People are gravitating now towards natural medicines like CBD. It's wonderful.
What else in terms of how people get on? You know, we've gone through a stage where lots of people, partners even, have split up or have had to live together and be on opposite sides of the aisle. How do people come now? Because I know there was a period of time where people weren't even talking to each other, and now it's normalizing. How do we have a culture of forgiveness?
Tolerance.
Compassion. And dialogue, because we've lost dialogue. You know, Q&A didn't do a single thing around anything of value during this time. You know, we were taken away the opportunity for real open dialogue about the things that matter most.
I think this is where, Eva, we have to be a little emotionally intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I've bungled that so many times lately because, you know, in my desperation as a healthcare worker, to want to convince people, to want to protect people. And that's probably the rescuer in me, you know, doing my thing. But
Mr. Fix
It. Yeah, it is. It is. And of course, as a healthcare worker,
I would never do something so silly myself.
I think there's a little bit of... so I think a lot
family.
Of healthcare workers have that rescue kind of mentality, saviour mentality about them. And
absolutely.
There are some people, as we talked about earlier in this, who can't get their head out of the sand because the gravity of what they will see and have to realise is tough.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to have compassion for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I still feel for some of the healthcare workers like myself who are really hurting and are still prohibited from working in their profession. So it's a really, we have to have these conversations because it's only in bursting that big pustule and having things come out that the real, and I did wound care for a long time, so I'm, pardon the analogy, I know, but, you know, every good nurse likes a bit of pus. It's just that whole, you know, the healing will be so much more rapid if we can expose all the crud that's been going on, you know.
So are you saying that when you burst the pustule,
well, we're going to have to move away
Does it heal faster?
It does.
I thought you were meant to just leave things. Like,
I actually thought that with burns and blisters, newer way of thinking.
Really?
Yes. Get rid of it. Get the healing process.
And you use honey as well.
Manuka honey.
Incredible.
Fabulous healing agent. Yeah, really good. Natural medicine.
In hospitals it's being used. Yes. It's fantastic.
So we do. And look, there are so many people I know I need to say sorry to. There are so many friends that I still don't connect with because for so long I tried to tell them, I tried to warn them. I saw
how
them
annoying are you?
If you were trying to tell them and warn them, why do you need to say sorry?
Because I've...
Of your manner?
No, not at all, because I found it so hard to be in their house. I couldn't walk into their house like I used to and take a salad in or a bottle of wine. I had no money. I couldn't buy anything. They were still welcoming me into their home, but for me and my self-esteem to be able to walk in, I couldn't contribute anything. I'd have the phone ringing and I'd have a health worker over in New South Wales beside themselves needing support, so I'd have to leave the dinner and sit and console someone on the phone. And I was having to turn around then head back into the dinner and pretend life was normal and I was going to be able to talk about the last basketball game that my children were banned from playing. It was just such a surreal time. I was a coward. I backed out. I couldn't be part of it anymore because it was too hard. So there's still some friendships that I desperately need to apologise to those people because it was a really hard time for us to deal with normality. What was normal?
Well, there was a lot of judgment happening, and it was very interesting, though, from a social experiment.
You know, a lot of people are saying, oh, you know, it was a couple of years ago, it's past now, you know, we got through it, nobody needs to be held to account. Are you serious?
How do we stop it happening again if we don't actually hold people to account?
Almost everybody I speak to says, you know, get off your horse, it's just leave it alone, we're over it.
Well, that's invisible.
And these same people are in charge of what is going to happen next. I mean, this is just, and how do we wake people up? Like you're talking about compassion and tolerance.
We keep doing
that dialogue is really hard because then you have to rely on somebody else listening and talking to you, and they might be in a different situation. But I'm saying, how do you go forward from that? It's really hard. There are two camps. You now recognize how many of the people you know think one way and think another way, and that, I think, infiltrates every situation.
The hardest part about that is living life because you naturally gravitate towards those that you have commonality with.
Of course.
And so, look, this has been a really testing thing for me in my life, and I'm quite happy to talk about it, is that I've got a beautiful human as a partner who is totally down the narrative of he got injected because he felt that he needed to do that. It was the right thing community-wise to do, you know, to... Mm-hmm. He believed in the injection.
Well, he was told it would stop transmission.
Yeah.
But I gave him the choice. I said, if you're doing this because you feel like you need to provide for us to pay for the mortgage to have a job, I would much rather we sell the house and we rent, we go somewhere for your health. I'd much rather. But if you're doing this because you believe in what is in that syringe, and I don't know any GPs that could tell you exactly what is in that syringe, then I can't stop you. If you're making this choice because you believe it, that's your choice. I can't stop you.
He's not a health professional.
He is. So it's been a very clever setup because it's forced me to have compassion for people that make that choice. I don't know if we'll go the distance of time. He's a good person and we co-parent really well at the moment. And I have a lot of respect for the person that he is. But whether our paradigms will see us on the same page in the end, I don't know.
It's like being different religions, isn't it?
It's
sort of come to that point.
I believe the vaccination cult is a religion. And that's probably a topic that is a little bit maybe
and the unvaccination cult is also a religion.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think it's just the perspective.
It depends on where you choose to place your faith.
Well, it's not just faith, I think. I've done decades of research and nothing will motivate a mother like the prospect of having a child to explore the data.
Look, we all want the dialogue to happen. There's been a lot of calls for debates which are not being had and we need to do that. We'd love to pull in some people into this place and have... If anyone out there would like to debate...
Are you open to do that? Absolutely.
If anyone would like, anyone listening, anyone have friends who might want to come and have a chat and present the other side, that would be fabulous.
But Eva, the most important part of that would be the need for absolute informed choice.
Why don't we get Josh Burns in to defend Labor's mandate? He's an expert on that. He'd know the answers.
Because you've got to queue him up with all the other things that they've been doing wrong lately and we've got enough people to want to talk to him and he won't come in.
Josh.
But he told me he was interested.
There's a Labor Party conference on at the moment, remember? It's the next 3 days.
What are they? They're planning to nuke Israel, aren't they?
Something like that, yeah. They've changed their...
Politically speaking,
can we talk about Maui then as well? If you...
Unfortunately, we've run out of time, folks.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kim. You've been listening to The Third Opinion Uncensored, if you hadn't worked that one out. And we've been talking about all things COVID with Kim McConchie, who is a nurse, an obstetric sonographer who was deregistered during COVID times, worked with the IVF clinics and has a lot to say and would love to have you back. She's got a great radio voice.
Thank you so much. It's been the most. I can't believe it's been.
Yeah. Would you like a show? Are you interested in converting?
Because you got to have faith.
You're very generous. Thank you, guys. It's been a wonderful hour. I can't believe it's gone.
See you next week.
אני עומדת מהצד ומשגיחה אני עומדת מהצד ומשגיחה